This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and it is the 5th of February 2011 here in Japan, but it is the 4th of February 2011 in Canada, where I'm joined on the line by Dr. James Beck, a professor emeritus of medical biophysics at the University of Calgary, who holds a doctorate in medicine from Washington University School of Medicine and biophysics from the University of California, Berkeley. And he is the co-author with previous Corbett Report guest Paul Connett of The Case Against Fluoride. And he currently resides in my hometown of Calgary, Alberta, Canada. So, Dr. James Beck, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today.
You're welcome. By the way, don't forget H. Spedding Micklem is a co-author of the book that Dr. Connett and I co-authored.
That's right. Yes. Sorry, I did not mention that. But yes, and that is available from Chelsea Green at chelseagreen.com is the publisher of that book. So I will put a link in that so people can go and check that book out in its format. So that's very interesting and very exciting. And I want to hear more about that book in particular. But before we get into that, maybe we can hear about yourself and your background. For those of us who don't know what a medical biophysicist is or how you got into this fluoride debate, perhaps you can tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the medical biophysics is really just an indication that it was a division in the Faculty of Medicine of biophysics, but being in the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Calgary at that time, it was designated medical biophysics. And my background, as you say, is in medicine. And but I gave up medicine very early and went to the University of California on a postdoctoral fellowship to do some research and ended up in the PhD program. So I have, since that time, which I got the PhD in 1962, since that time I've been involved in teaching and research. I retired from the University of Calgary in 1991.
I see. And so how did you begin to approach the fluoride debate?
Well, about 10 years ago, here in Calgary, I was asked by a family practitioner to join a committee of himself and five dentists who were opposed to fluoridation. Up to that time, I really hadn't thought about fluoridation, despite the plebiscites that we had in Calgary. I didn't get into it. And when I was asked to do that, I first thought about it, and the ethics of the issue just appalled me. And so just on that basis alone, I thought that it ought not to be done. And so thinking that it ought not to be done, I began to look into the science of the practice. And because of the science is what tells us whether it's effective in preventing cavities and tells us whether it's safe to ingest for humans. So I spent a good bit of time over the last 10 years looking at the scientific literature. And it was very late during that period when I was involved in sort of commenting on Paul Connett's work on the literature he had accumulated over 16 years in his case. He probably has the best collection of information on fluoridation in the world, which he amassed with the help of his wife, Ellen, and his son, Michael. In any case, Spedding Micklem also was engaged in looking at what Paul was doing, and Paul Connett then invited the two of us to join him in writing this book, which is primarily dedicated to looking at the question of efficacy and the question of safety. And those are scientific issues. And we also include in the book a brief discussion of the ethics. That's brief because it's a very simple aspect and doesn't require much writing or speaking about. And also there's included in it some history about how we got into this status of having imposed on such a large population in the world a practice that is so patently wrong.
That's right. So when you refer to the ethical issue here, you're referring to the idea of force medicating people through the water supply.
Yes, yes. Well, the practice of fluoridation of a public water supply fails the requirements of medical ethics in several ways. And one of the ways you just mentioned, it's forcing a medication on people without their informed consent. That's a serious violation of medical ethics and alone should prevent the practice. But in addition, it's using a medication that's not approved for human consumption, at least not in the United States and in Canada. Well, in Canada, Health Canada does approve of it, but without basis. In the United States, the Federal Drug Administration classifies it as an unapproved drug. So that's another point on which it fails ethically. It fails also because the person who's receiving it doesn't have the option to stop it. And it also fails because it's administered at a dose that is not controlled. So those are all serious offenses, if you will, on ethical grounds.
Absolutely, yes. Very serious offenses and ones that are often avoided by proponents of the fluoridation idea. But let's get specifically into the Calgary case and let's talk about when and how Calgary first started adding fluoride to the water supply and why the recent debate has started to take place.
Well, it has a long history in Calgary. There were, before 1989, four plebiscites, which, by the way, is an absurd way to decide how to medicate oneself, where you gather your neighbors together and ask what medicine to take. But at any rate, there were four plebiscites at which the public, the voting public, or a small fraction of the voting public, rejected the notice, practice of fluoridation of the public water supply. They rejected it usually in most cases by a fairly narrow margin, you know, say 53% against and so on. But subsequently, there were two other plebiscites. Well, in the meantime, I should say that fluoridation was begun after the 1989 plebiscite, and so that by 1991 we were drinking fluoridated water in Calgary. Another plebiscite was held later in the late 1990s, and in the last two it was approved by this narrow margin of the votes of a minority of qualified voters. So we've had it with us with the sanction of a public vote for some time now. And the fact that the last two plebiscites expressed favor, narrow as it was, of fluoridation, has made it difficult for some aldermen on the city council to stop the program of fluoridation, even though they think it should be stopped, because they say the people decided to put it in, then the people have to decide to take it out. But there's a lot of argument currently because now, well, I should say that the current furor in Calgary started on February 5th, when in the Calgary Herald, a major newspaper in Calgary, published the news that Alderman Drew Farrell was going to introduce a motion to stop before City Council to stop fluoridation. And at that time, she had 9 of her colleagues, so that would be 10 aldermen, on a council of 14 aldermen and one mayor. She had 10 who wanted to stop fluoridation. And so the issue was then thrust once again into the limelight in Calgary, and a lot of discussion occurred. At the next council meeting, Alderman Farrell introduced that motion, and it was not accepted because there were several new councillors, aldermen, where, by the way, we're changing to councillor at the next civic election, so I'm mixing this up. But some aldermen were new to the council, and others even didn't feel they knew enough about fluoridation to make a decision on it. So they wanted to have a public consultation. They mandated the Standing Policy Committee on Utilities and their Environment to hold a public consultation, which they did on January 26th. And this went on from 9:30 in the morning to 8 or so in the evening, and about 40 people testified before the committee, and others submitted written testimony. And that same evening, the committee decided to recommend to the city council that they stop fluoridation by a vote of 4 or 5 to 1. It was either 4 or 5 in favor of the recommendation to stop fluoridation and 1 against. During that discussion, all that day, two things came up that could delay things. One was the idea of a panel of experts to review fluoridation and advise the council. Now, we've had one of those panels of, I say, so-called experts, because there were 5 on that panel. I think the only one that was really qualified to make a judgment on part of the issue was a statistician, and he issued a minority report. The majority report was to continue fluoridation but reduce the concentration of the water from 1 part per million to 0.7 parts per million. So other thing that arose during the discussion, aside from a panel of experts, another one, would be to have another plebiscite. Well, the plebiscite, in my view, is just absurd now as it was before. But because of the suggestion of a plebiscite, there's been a lot of there have been letters and editorials and so on in the press, some of which say that that's only right that people be given the freedom of choice and so on. But if a plebiscite is held and you vote in favor of fluoridation and it passes, then only those voters have the freedom of choice. The ones who don't want fluoridation don't have any freedom of choice. So the only way to have freedom of choice, of course, is to stop fluoridation, and then make fluoride treatments of one sort or another available to people who choose to have it. But that doesn't seem to enter the minds of the people who are ranting that we're violating democracy and so on by having, if council is allowed to decide on its own rather than giving the decision to the voting public. So coming Monday, this next Monday, February the 7th, there will be a motion put before the city council, which will say two things. One is that the city stop fluoridation. The other is that the money saved by stopping fluoridation, which is considerable, I'll come back to that if you want, that be applied to providing some help to children of low-income families with respect to dental care. So we'll see on Monday what is done. Now, the options for the council are to pass those motions, to reject any change from the situation now, or to say we won't make a decision until we have a panel report to us, or until we have a plebiscite. If it's a plebiscite, it won't be done until the next civic elections, which are 2.5 years away. So those of us who oppose fluoridation on the grounds that it's not effective, that it's not safe, and that it's not ethical, are hoping that on Monday the council will pass the motion as it is introduced.
Well, certainly I think most of my listeners will join you in that hope, but let's get back to that issue of the monetary savings that could be made here. So what are we looking at in terms of how much money can be saved by not fluoridating?
Well, the cost of just supplying the chemical, which what we use here in Calgary is what's used in most fluoridated places in North America, and that's hexafluorosilicic acid. It's obtained by scrubbers used in the phosphate, principally in the phosphate fertilizer industry, as hexafluorosilicic acid in a 23% solution, and it's then shipped around North America to be put in our water, whereas it's illegal to put it in a river or a landfill or in the ocean. So it would be very costly to get rid of it legally if it weren't possible to sell it to jurisdictions that fluoridate the water. Well, the cost of that substance for Calgary is about $750,000 a year. But in order to continue fluoridation, the city of Calgary would have to upgrade or repair their equipment, which does this the fluoridation. It's a very special equipment because the substance as received is so corrosive and toxic. So that upgrade would cost, I'm told, from $6 to $7 million. So that would be have to be done to continue fluoridation. Then we would have to continue $750,000 a year to supply the chemical. And then some years down the line, we'll have to do some other $1 million of restoration of the system over and over again until we stop fluoridation. So it's a substantial cost to the city, and it's a substantial amount of money that could do a lot of good applied to helping those people in our city who don't have access to dental care and who don't have the resources to help their children take care of the teeth and so on.
Well, you raise an important point, and it's one that I often make, but I think it bears repeating over and over and over, because it is so important and so central to this debate, is that, of course, people think that we are using pharmaceutical-grade sodium fluoride, but of course it is hexafluorosilicic acid, which is absolutely not the same thing. So for those who may not know this, tell us a little bit about that that acid and how it's created and what constituent components and other trace byproducts are found in it.
Well, okay, as far as the hexafluorosilicic acid, also called hydrofluorosilicic acid, is concerned, it's obtained because the fluoride is a component of the minerals mined from the Earth's crust, which is the source of the phosphate that the fertilizer industry is after. But in getting that phosphate out, they carry along with it considerable amount of fluoride. And the fluoride that is produced by the scrubbers, you can get rid of that fluoride by letting it the materials out of the production process pass through a mist of water. It combines with water, and you end up getting hydrofluorosilicic acid. But along with that, you get contaminants that come from the Earth's crust. Those contaminants include arsenic, they include lead, and they include other heavy metals such as cadmium, and even probably a bit of uranium, because this same sources in the Earth's crust are used to sometimes as a source of uranium. So when we get this substance as a 23% solution of hexafluorosilicic acid, we get some serious contaminants as well that are very recognized as very dangerous to human health. And some of the proponents say, well, the dilution of this substance is so great that all of the fluorine in the hexafluorosilicic acid becomes free fluoride ion in the water. Well, that's essentially true. However, when we drink the water, we introduce the silicates and the fluoride ion into a very, very acid environment in our stomachs, a pH of something like 1.2. That's extremely acidic. And under those conditions, the fluoride, a good part of it will recombine with the silicates. And so you end up with fluorosilicates in your intestinal tract, and we know that, or we have observations that histological changes, damage to the mucosa of the intestinal system appears in the presence of water which is artificially fluoridated. Another point that was often made and confuses people is the proponents insist that, well, fluoride is natural. Well, of course it's natural. All the elements in the periodic table of elements are natural. But the difference between a natural source of fluoride and fluoridated water with hexafluorosilicic acid is that natural fluoride comes from the Earth's crust and entirely or almost entirely as calcium fluoride. And calcium fluoride doesn't dissociate readily in water the way sodium fluoride does or the way the fluoride from hexafluorosilicic acid does. So it's in the gut as calcium fluoride, and it's not, a large part of it is not absorbed. It's excreted with the feces. So that natural fluoride and hexafluorosilicic acid are quite different in terms of water fluoridation. That's, I think, an important point. In addition, we know that in fluoridated water, when in a city or a jurisdiction where the system is fluoridated, that there is found a higher level of lead in children's blood. And there are several papers, fairly recent ones, that have shown this association with higher levels of blood, of lead in children's blood and the use of hexafluorosilicic acid to fluoridate the water. And it's agreed, I think, opponents of fluoridation and proponents of fluoridation and probably every physician in the world will acknowledges that lead is a very dangerous neurotoxin. And that's why we've been struggling for the past few decades to get it out of paint, to get it out of children's toys and so on. So that's another difference between say using a pharmaceutical grade sodium fluoride and using hexafluorosilicic acid. We don't want to elevate the levels of lead in our children's blood. It has been said often in the past decades by proponents that, what are you worried about? Fluoride is a natural substance and it's, and we need it. Even the Institute of Medicine in the United States some years ago said, under pressure from pro-fluoridation people, that fluoride is a nutrient. Well, there is no evidence that fluoride is essential for the human diet. So it's not a nutrient. And it actually, the Institute of Medicine was chastised for this and put under pressure. And so they finally relented and said, okay, fluoride's not a nutrient, but it's a beneficial element. Where they get that bizarre designation, I don't know. But I think it's an indication of one of the problems we have in opposing fluoridation, indication of the fact that people don't want to be seen, especially people in authoritative positions, don't want to be seen to have changed their minds. Those are the points I think are important to make about the substance that's used to fluoridate water in over 90% of cases in North America. Using the pharmaceutical grade sodium fluoride would be very much more expensive than what we have now.
So tell us about the mood of the people in Calgary and what the sentiment on the street is about this issue.
Well, there's several sources, of getting an impression of what the mood is, none of which are very reliable. We have polls in the two major newspapers, which usually come out just slightly against now, whereas in the past they would be just slightly for, in terms of, 55% against 45% or something like that. But, those are unreliable. One person can vote 100 times there. We have also, I have a list of people. It's maybe several hundred people. They're not only from Calgary, but they are against fluoridation, and they've been sending messages to the alderman and the mayor and so on. One important change now is from the last few years is that the Calgary Herald, which is, I guess we could say, the major newspaper in Calgary, has the day after this news came out that Alderman Farrell was going to introduce this motion, I think it would have been January the 6th, the Herald had an editorial which was a very well reasoned editorial with just one mistake in it, against fluoridation, which is a change in position. And subsequently, they've had one or two other editorials or op-ed pieces against fluoridation. And I think that's an indication of how things have changed. And I think it's important for those aldermen who want to stop fluoridation to have that sort of backing, so they might feel a little more comfortable doing something that in the past has been contrary to the majority's wishes. But I think now it's not contrary to the majority's wishes, and that's a big help. The interest in the public consultation, I think, was very strong, and there were a lot of testimonies there, very thoughtful, from people who were not scientists or physicians or dentists, but who had stories to tell and felt very strongly about the issue. And there were some who favored fluoridation, who gave their viewpoints. And the Alberta Health Services had five people there. There were two medical officers of health and one dental officer of health, a dietitian and a community health worker, and they said a lot of things that were just plain wrong, and there was a considerable spin doctoring. They don't like to say that fluoride's a medicine because they don't want us to say they're mass medicating. One medical officer of health in private finally agreed after a verbal struggle to say mass administration, but not mass medication. That's this kind of spin doctoring they do. And so I think the mood has changed, and I hope that it's changed significantly enough to stop it here. In addition to Calgary, though, we have considerable hope for two more cities in southern Alberta, and that might very well stop fluoridation this year. So that's a good sign. And if we could get at Edmonton, we would have two-thirds or more of the population of Alberta. And the next step is to make it illegal in Alberta. And then on to Canada.
Absolutely. Well, it is interesting and exciting to see the change in Herald editorial position, and I know you have been featured in a lot of reports on this issue in the Calgarian and Albertan media. So what can you say about the media coverage from your own perspective?
Well, I have, as you say, I've participated in that, and there have been some exchanges via the form of op-ed pieces in the Herald, some pro-fluoridation, and Dr. Bob Dixon and I have written op-ed pieces against fluoridation. And I think it's creditable for the Calgary Herald to have done that. It's certainly the kind of role you want to see a newspaper play in a community. And the exchanges of information may have been helpful to people in coming to their conclusions about it. But a lot of people, of course, feel very disconnected from the debate. They feel they don't have the time or resources to devote to it, and don't know enough about it, and or have a background that makes it easy to learn enough about it. And so we're always, you know, struggling with that. We want people to be informed, and we try our best to inform them. And I'm appreciative of the Herald's recent role, because they've allowed some of us to try to inform people.
Well, that is excellent news, and it is a certainly a change from years past. So I guess just wrapping up, we should talk a little bit about the book, The Case Against Fluoride, and how people can get a copy of it.
Oh, well, yes, I'll be glad to do that. I mean, it's written by Paul Connett and H. Spedding Micklem and I. And its primary focus is on the science behind the question of efficacy or effectiveness of fluoridation as a preventive of dental caries or cavities, and the science behind its safety. And it examines a number of different toxicities, some of which are quite strongly associated with fluoridation at the levels of one part per million in the water. It also deals with some associations which aren't so strongly made from research. But you see, the problem that the viewpoint that's often lost here is that the proponents should have a higher bar than the opponents, because if there's enough doubt, then you have to balance against any benefit. And it is clearly shown by the best research on the subject that there is little or no benefit in terms of preventing caries. And if there's little or no benefit, or if it's just doubtful, and there are toxicities that are not so doubtful, then it's an unacceptable practice. So that's the way the book deals with that. The book it also gives some history and some of the sort of political, you might say, problems that arise in trying to get the issue discussed. The way the book is laid out is makes it easy for its use by persons without scientific backgrounds, but also by the scientists and the dentists and the physicians. There are six sections in it, and there are 24 chapters, and the way it's done is in there's a section, for example, on the evidence for harm, and in that, chapters 11 to 19 are on different possible harms. And in the end notes, there are sections of the end notes that are specific to each of those chapters. So if you want to look at the problem of possible harm to the brain, there's a chapter, Fluoride in the Brain, and a separate section in the end notes which gives all the references we use, so that the scientists or someone who doesn't trust us can go to the scientific literature and find what we're discussing and look at it for themselves. But those things are discussed in everyday language in the text. And it makes it possible, if you don't want to read through the book, it makes it possible to use as a very convenient reference. And we hope people will use it. Now, the book is available from Chelsea Green, the publisher, and they have a website, and you can get see on the website how to order it. That's also available through Amazon.com, and it's also available through Amazon.ca, which is probably probably a simpler way to get it for Canadians. And Amazon.com or Chelsea Green, which is in the United States, might be more convenient for people in the United States. It's a paperback. It's not very expensive. It's different in different places and different times on the internet, but that's easily, information is easily accessible.
That's right. And before we leave, I think I would once again like to urge listeners to go to the Fluoride Action Network homepage at fluoridealert.org for the incredible wealth of resources and information on this subject there. But are there any other websites that you'd like to direct listeners to?
Well, the Fluoride Alert, I think, is probably the best for on fluoridation, because it gives news. And there you see the cities and jurisdictions, and there are quite a lot of them over the last few months, who are refusing to start fluoridation or stopping fluoridation. You get that sort of news. You also would get the news about the CDC and the EPA's changing their safe levels of fluoride, and which has happened just in the last 2 or 3 weeks. But in addition to that sort of news, there's a bibliography, which is categorized by you know, subsections of the issue of fluoridation. And it's a running bibliography that's kept up to date. A similar bibliography is available on a website for Second Look. The fluoridealert.org is the one for the Fluoride Action Network, the first one I just described. The Second Look is, you could Google that, but it's URL is something like secondlook.org. I'm not sure now what it is, but that's easily found. So both of those are very good sites for information on it. And they would include papers, for example, that the proponents like, as well as papers that the opponents like.
Indeed. Well, on the subject of news, I certainly hope we're going to have some good news from Calgary on Monday, and hopefully, as you say, there will be a knock-on effect, and it will affect other municipalities around Canada, and hopefully even around the world. So, Dr. Beck, thank you very much for joining us to share your insights, and I look forward to perhaps speaking with you in the future as this story continues to develop.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you for having me.